From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, NPR's Nina Totenberg. She's covered the Supreme Court for 30 years. How has the court changed in that time? Who are the most important justices of the modern era? You'll hear answers to those and other questions. Also, the story of one of America's literary geniuses, playwright Eugene O'Neill. First, the Academy Awards are given out on Sunday. Joining me to discuss the Oscars are three local film critics, Carla Meyer of the Sacramento Bee, Jim Lane of the Sacramento News and Review, and Gary Chu, who writes reviews for TulsaTVMemories.com. He's also, as you might well know, an announcer on the classical radio station KXPR. Carla, Jim, Gary, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Before we talk about some of the specific films, here's a general point. None of the leading films in this year's Academy Awards was really a hit at the box office, and it was a similar story last year. What's going on? Are good films getting less popular with the public, or is it rather that the Academy has stopped caring about which movies really resonate with the public and is now just saying these films are the best ones?
I don't think this is necessarily a new trend. If you look back over the last, 60, 75 years of the Oscars, they've always given the awards to the movies they were most willing to brag about, not necessarily the ones that made the most money. You look at, in 1942, probably the top, probably the top money-making movie was Blondie Goes to War, but it didn't get nominated for any Oscars. I think it's a little more pronounced and noticeable now because there's so much information about box office and so much information about the backstories of movies, through magazines like Premiere and yes. Entertainment Weekly. So the people are more aware of that. But I think that's been kind of a general trend since the very beginning.
Okay. Carla, are you encouraged when you look at the list of films and actors and directors and other artists who are nominated this year?
I am encouraged. I think that rather than there have been in past, say, the past 5 years, there have been some real fillers in the Best Picture category. I'm thinking of like Chocolat and Finding Neverland, those films. This one's, I don't agree with all of the film's placement in the Best Picture category, but I think that they're all worthy enough films.
Okay. Gary Chu, the most nominated film this year is Brokeback Mountain. What do you think of Brokeback Mountain?
I think it's just about the second best movie of the year.
Second best?
Just about.
Okay, quickly, what's the best in your opinion?
Well, my favorite movie is Crash, okay, which I thought was going to be great when I saw it last April. It's poorly timed, I think, in being released, but I think it's the best movie of the year. Brokeback Mountain's a good movie, but I just think that there are some other movies that are just about as good or maybe slightly better.
Okay, well, let's stick with Brokeback first. We will get to Crash a little later. We'll start, though, with a clip from Brokeback Mountain. And this scene features the two cowboys on Brokeback Mountain talking about what the future might hold for them.
What if you and me had a little ranch somewhere, a little cow and calf operation? Be sweet life. You know, hell, Lorraine's old man, you better give me a down payment to get lost. I mean, he more or less already said it.
I told you it ain't gonna be that way. You got your wife and baby in Texas, and I got my life in Riverton. The bottom line is, we're around each other, and this thing grabs hold of us again in the wrong place, in the wrong time, and we're dead.
A clip from Brokeback Mountain. So, Gary, tell us what you liked about Brokeback Mountain.
Well, I think the thing I like best about it is the fact that it's approaching a subject in a sort of a matter-of-fact way that Hollywood has always danced around in different ways, or they've flat out made a totally gay movie for another section of viewers. And it's very real, and I think it's a very touching film. I think it's a good motion picture.
Mm-hmm. Carla, did you find it believable?
Did I find Brokeback believable?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. It's my favorite film of the year. I thought that it was, for me, just listening to that snippet that you had, there have been so many parodies of Brokeback Mountain that you hear that, and so you have to remember your initial reaction. And my initial reaction was, I think that my breath was taken away at parts of Brokeback Mountain because of how authentic it seemed and how authentic the performances were.
Yeah. And Jim?
I think I like Brokeback Mountain quite a lot, too. I think it would be my personal choice of the five nominees. Having said that, though, although I think all the nominees are good, none of them are made my top 15.
Really?
So, I think this is a good collection of nominees, especially in the case that there's always seems to be at least one really lousy movie nominated for Best Picture, and there isn't this year. So,
okay.
But I think that is probably the best of the five nominees.
There's been so much hype and talk about Brokeback Mountain. Quickly from each of you, for people who have not yet seen Brokeback Mountain, is this one of these films that is going to disappoint because you've heard so much about it, and then when you see it, it just cannot possibly live up? Or is it really good enough to transcend all of the hype and so on?
I think that no matter how much people talk about it, you don't know what it's like until you see it. But I do think, having seen it in with different audiences, that it is not for very young people. I think it is for people who've experienced life and experienced regret is who it really resonates with.
Jim?
I think that overpraise has probably hurt more good movies than unfair abuse. And I think all of the nominees this year have been overpraised. And in that sense, I don't think it's going to live up to the hype. I think it's a very good movie. And I think if people can overlook some of the hype they may have heard, I think that any reasonable viewer, again, you know, with a certain level of maturity, will be able to respond to it.
And Gary?
I was let down just a bit because I've been hearing about it so much. It won a Canadian Film Festival Award like a year and a half ago or something like that. I can't remember. And I kept hearing about it. And then when I saw it, I was only slightly let down, but I still thought it was a great film. The thing that I don't like about Brokeback Mountain, and I've never heard anybody else say this, is I thought the establishing part of the film where the two guys are in the mountains and getting the relationship going out in sheep herding lasted a little too long for the rest of what the movie was about, because there was a different pace in the rest of the movie, and I think it was an extension of the short story. I don't know because I didn't read the short story.
Okay, Carla, you like the film a lot. What's your response to what Gary's saying?
I thought the pacing was fine, because I believe that you needed to establish that part of the reason that they got together was the isolation, and you needed to establish that isolation, and also just that isolation also helped the relationship to start in the first place. And I think it's also really beautiful. It is a different pace than the rest of the movie, but it didn't bother me.
Okay. Well, let's move on now to another one of the top nominated films in this year's Academy Awards. Brokeback Mountain got 8, I believe, and three films got 6 nominations, including the movie Crash. And we have a clip from Crash here. And this scene is where you'll hear Matt Dillon, who plays a clearly racist police officer, who he and his partner have pulled over a vehicle that at first they thought was a vehicle they were looking for. Turns out quite soon that was not the vehicle, but Matt Dillon thinks he sees an interracial sex scene going on inside. And let's pick up the film from there.
I want you to stand on your right foot, touch your nose with the index finger of your left hand.
I told you he doesn't drink.
Ma'am, I'm only going to tell you one time to stay in the vehicle.
Ma'am.
Honey, I'm okay. I got this.
Don't you ma'am me. Who the hell do you think you're talking to?
Look, officer, My wife has had a couple drinks.
All right, both of you, turn around, put your hands on top of your head and interlock your fingers.
No, wait a minute. We're only a block
hands
away from
our
house. Hands
on your head, interlock your fingers.
That's
hands
not
on
even
your
necessary.
Head, interlock your fingers.
Look,
here
I'm a
go.
Television director. Wait! And me and my wife are just coming home from an award show.
Calm
down. Calm down.
There's nothing wrong.
Put your hands on top of your head, ma'am.
Will you just do what he says?
Put your hands on top of your head, ma'am.
You keep your filthy hands off me. You pig.
Just stop talking.
That's quite a mouth you have. Of course you know that.
That's a clip from the movie Crash. Gary Chu, earlier on you said that was your favorite film of the year. What did you like about Crash?
Oh, I don't think we have enough time. I think it's the most well-written film I've seen in a long time. And it brings together some things in people that they don't know that they have within them in terms of some of their instincts that are hidden maybe in denial or whatever. And the scene that we're leading up to with Matt Dillon in this scene right here, in the wreck scene, it's so famous in the film. a very moving and compelling cinema for me. And I've seen the movie twice, and every time I see it, it's one of the few movies that just flat nails me. It's overwhelming. It's okay. An excellent film.
Jim Lane, this obviously is not in your top 15 either, but what did you think of Crash?
Okay, I thought it was a very good movie. I thought I did have some problems with the writing, although I thought the dialogue was excellent and very evocative. I thought it leaned on coincidence to an extent that would embarrass Charles Dickens.
That's a good line, Jim.
And within that, and I think that may be, if anything, loses it the Oscar for the original screenplay. I think that may be it. But you know, I think this may have an inside track for Best Picture too. I think there's a backlash against Brokeback Mountain that not a lot of people have talked about, and that is the backlash of the unions, because this film was shot in Canada for $14 million. And I think that there may be a backlash on that. Nothing to do with the theme, but just the fact of it being a runaway Canadian production may cost it with the voting Academy.
Carla, what did you think of Crash?
It's my least favorite of the five nominees. And I found it, as Jim said, way too coincidental, way too concerned with these racial issues to the degree that seems to be all that people are thinking about in it. And I just found it sort of alternately brilliant and contrived, but the contrived, I think, overwhelmed the contrivance has overwhelmed the brilliance. And I'm just sad that The Constant Gardener didn't make it into the top five, and this film did.
I would agree with that.
Well, what would you have gotten rid of? Are you able to say that?
Well, I'll tell you what, I have come not totally prepared because there are two of the films that I haven't seen. I haven't seen Walk the Line, and I haven't seen, what's the other one? Munich, those two films. And I sort of select what films I want to review anyway. I don't have to, I can do it on my own, sort of. And I agree with what most everyone is saying about the other films, except I really can't give you any input to Munich or Walk the Line.
Okay. Jim, what would be your best film of the year then if it's not in the nominated?
Without hesitation, he said, Cinderella Man. I think releasing that movie in May, just 3 days after the last Star Wars saga, was inexplicable to me. I almost suspect deliberate sabotage. This is a movie that should have been. And if I were Ron Howard, I would be kicking somebody around the Universal lot right about now. But I think that was the best movie of the year.
Okay, Carla?
My best movie of the year was Brokeback Mountain. Yes. But I would say Capote is a close second. Capote is a really well-made film. And then the other ones in the best picture category, Good Night, Good Luck, and Munich, and Crash, they're all in a different lower tier for me. But of those, Good Night and Good Luck, I liked. I agree with you that Cinderella Man was a very well-made movie. But I don't think that you can blame the release date in the summer, because Crash was released even before it was released in May. I don't know what happened to Cinderella Man, but I know that the audience didn't go see it. And my theory is that people from the title didn't want to go see it, like boxing fans, because it's got fantastic fight scenes in it. Mm-hmm. And I heard that from a few people. They were saying, well, I want to go see Raging Bull. I don't want to see some sissy movie called Cinderella Man. And I'm not kidding. And I remember I was in a preview audience and are watching a trailer for it, and everyone was completely rapt through the whole trailer until they said the name of it, and they said Cinderella Man, and everyone started laughing.
Yeah.
And I really believe that put off a lot of the audience.
I agree with you on that. I do.
Well, let's wrap this up with talking about, from each of you, a film or an actor or some other artist who has been completely missed out of the Academy Awards this year, or at least is not being sufficiently recognized with a prominent enough nomination. What movie or actor isn't getting the credit they're due in the Academy Awards? Let's start with you, Carla.
This might be a little nuts, but I think Naomi Watts in King Kong, I think she was great in that movie. I think that the challenges that she faced in that film were pretty great in having to work against, you know, blue screen and special effects, and I think she was very powerful in the role.
Okay. Gary, too?
I think that Paul Giamatti is, again, another overlooked great actor. He was overlooked last year, and he's in Cinderella Man this year.
He's nominated,
but I think he's going to be overlooked again, is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
And he's a marvelous actor.
Yes.
He's almost as good as Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Okay. So, yes, Jim?
I would say, well, of course, Russell Crowe in Cinderella Man, but one performance that I'd like to draw people's attention to, and that's little Georgie Henley in The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I think she should have been nominated for Best Supporting Actress. Seldom has someone so small carried so much of something so big.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. Carla Meyer of the Sacramento Bee, Gary Chu, and Jim Lane of the Sacramento News and Review. Thank you all.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, NPR's Nina Totenberg on the Supreme Court. She talks about current cases, the prospect of the court revisiting Roe v. Wade, and how the court has changed in the last 30 years. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ, I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can hear today's show and recent archive programs on the web at capradio.org/insight. That's also the place you can sign up for the Insight podcast. NPR's Nina Totenberg is one of America's top legal reporters. She's covered the Supreme Court and other legal institutions for more than three decades. Tonight, she speaks at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis. Her topic is the Supreme Court and its impact on you. I spoke yesterday with Nina Totenberg and asked her how she would compare the politics of the Supreme Court today with 30 years ago.
Well, to begin with, television and radio are there, which they weren't 30 years ago. And even 30 years ago, it could be a very partisan process, an ideological process. The first confirmation hearing I ever covered was the nomination of Abe Fortas to be Chief Justice. He was already a Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And Strom Thurmond and some other folks, conservatives, took out after him very hard on ideological grounds. And that didn't work. It didn't work, frankly, any more than the Democrats' opposition worked in the last few months against now Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito. But what did work against Fortas was a challenge to his ethical conduct. And in the end, Republicans filibustered his nomination and Democrats were not willing to break that filibuster. Because they thought there were serious questions about Fortas's ethical conduct. And I think that likely, as long as the party in power is the same in the White House and in the Congress, in the Senate, that likely is the only way you're going to defeat a nominee in most instances, is a challenge to that individual's ethical conduct. Something other than his ideology, unless his ideology is really wacko. But we've never actually seen that in modern times. I mean, when Robert Bork was defeated, he was defeated by a Democratic Senate, albeit with some Republican support, even though he was a Republican appointee.
Yes. Well, you mentioned ethical conduct, and you are, of course, well known in part for breaking the story of Anita Hill's allegations of sexual harassment by then-Judge Clarence Thomas, and that prompted the Senate to reopen his confirmation hearings. Of course, we know how that went. So even in a case where ethical conduct is an issue, it doesn't seem to derail nominations very often.
Well, it came very close to derailing the Thomas nomination, and you have to remember that I only learned of this story at the very end of the process. The disclosures in my report made it so that the Senate reopened the hearings right away, but with a very hard time limit of just a week between when the vote had initially been scheduled to the next time it would be scheduled. In the normal course of events, if your object is to defeat a nomination, you need to have a sort of a slow drum roll as you bring out the charges and then have day after day, drip, 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 more and more information. That's just not the way the Thomas charges unfolded, and they were sort of, and it was the closest vote to confirm somebody in certainly in modern times.
When that report was just about to air, what did you think would come of it? Did you think that it would have the impact that it did and still resonates to this day?
No, I had no idea of that. I actually thought there was a very good chance it was what I would call a 24-hour wonder. That is, that it would cause a certain amount of hubbub for about 24 hours, and then that Anita Hill would sort of disappear and the charges would disappear. Instead, she sort of stepped right up, had a press conference, appeared before the committee. And what I absolutely did not anticipate or understand had taken place was that there'd been a lot of women, millions and millions probably of working women, who had been in some fashion harassed by their supervisors and for whom this was a somehow formative experience. And they sort of vaporized the fax machines and the telephones in the offices of the Senate of the United States, making it so that it was impossible to simply look the other way to these charges. And that was true for Democrats as well as Republicans. I mean, it's easy now to say, well, you know, this was sort of a Democratic plot. The truth is that Democrats knew about these charges that Anita Hill had made and had done nothing about them, practically nothing.
Mm. Thinking about the confirmation process, so often the Senate hearings seem to be as much about senators pontificating at length with speeches that are supposedly questions. Why do the confirmations go so often like that? Is that because ultimately the senators know that chances are the justice will be confirmed, and it's not really about exposing anything in the nominee?
No, I actually don't think that's the case. I think that for the defenders of the nominee, they're not really interested in asking questions. The question format is merely a format, and they are only interested in making speeches to defend the nominee. But for those people who actually want to find out what the nominee's views are or undercut the nominee or raise questions about the nominee, I think they actually would like to ask real questions that would force an answer. But after all, these are not, for the most part, skilled litigators. That's not what they do for a living. It's not what most of them ever did for a living, even the ones who were prosecutors. They ran prosecution offices. They may have tried cases, but that's not the same as these kinds of hearings. And they have a limited amount of time. Very, in the case where you're talking about somebody who's been a judge and you're asking about the judge's conduct or the judge's decisions, you have it's kind of hard to summarize what the decision was in a way that hems in the nominee so he or she has to answer the question. So what they're left with is either reading questions that sound all too formulaic or trying to have an exposition of where they're going, a la Joe Biden, and it takes them way too long to do that, and they end up looking ridiculous. And a nominee who is disciplined and has been practicing for weeks, if not months, answers to what are quite predictable questions and answers that tell you as little as possible, a nominee almost always will best the senator. You know, there are some instances, you know, there's some times when I think senators actually have done pretty well. I actually thought that, for example, here we're not talking about a nomination process, but Senator Leahy's questioning of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez in the recent hearings about the NSA were pretty effective. And that when John Edwards, who was after all, is a trained litigator, when he was on the Judiciary Committee and he had nominees for the lower courts in front of him, he often was able to elicit real answers. But he had to do it in a very careful picking your way through one series of questions after another. It's a long and arduous process, and even a half an hour may not be long enough to get through even one whole point. So it's a frustrating enterprise, I think, for the senators, and it's definitely a frustrating enterprise for those who are listening.
Yes. A few days ago, lawmakers in South Dakota passed a law that essentially banned, that all but banned abortion in their state. And
it did ban it.
It did. Well, I thought there was an exception made for the...
If it's necessary to save the life of the mother. Yes. But that was always true in abortion cases.
Yes.
Even before Roe, you could have an abortion to save the life of a mother. That's. Mm. But it did ban it for all practical purposes.
Okay. Presumably, the lawmakers were inspired to do that because of the change of the makeup of the Supreme Court. Do you expect this to make its way up to the Supreme Court? And do you see the new makeup of the Supreme Court changing Roe v. Wade?
Well, those are two separate questions. Of course, it will make it to the Supreme Court because somebody, presumably abortion rights groups, will challenge this law, and they will win. At the first round, they will win because any judge in this country, any federal judge in this country, is still bound by Roe versus Wade and will strike down this law as unconstitutional. And so will the appeals courts, and somebody will appeal to the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court doesn't have to hear that case. There will be no what they call conflict in the circuits. Every federal appeals court in the country has ruled that a ban on abortion is unconstitutional if it's come to them, because that's what the Supreme Court has told them to rule. And the Supreme Court doesn't have to revisit that issue. It's revisited it 30-some-odd times and said it still upholds Roe for all practical purposes. But the second question you pose, which is does the new ideological makeup of the court, will that pose a threat to Roe? And my guess is that it will, but not in a direct sense. You know, you can preserve Roe technically, that is to say that women have a right to an abortion, but hollow out the meaning of that decision. You could uphold all manner of restrictions that in the past the court has struck down. Already next term we're going to hear whether partial birth abortion, a ban on partial birth abortion, is constitutional. 6 years ago, the court said it was not unless it had an exception to preserve the health of the mother. Now we're going to see if the court wants to change that decision, to reverse it. So then, okay, let's just assume for the sake of argument that a ban on partial birth, a so-called partial birth abortion, is constitutional. Well, then how about a ban not on 24-hour waiting periods, but 48-hour waiting periods or one-week waiting periods? That makes it very expensive for people to get abortions because they may have to go a long way to a clinic. And then how about other restrictions on other methods of abortion? And then how about restrictions that make it too expensive for clinics to be able to do abortions? And then next, how about requirements that a pregnant woman be told that life begins at conception? All kinds of things that would make it much, much more difficult and for all practical purposes in some states impossible to get an abortion. I could see that happening easier than I could an actual reversal of Roe.
Could you see the court having an interest or the ability to send this back to the states and say that a state with a pro-life majority could all but ban abortion, and that a state with a pro-choice majority could be very open in how it interprets the law?
Well, that's what it would be if you reversed Roe. But reversing Roe only means it goes back to the states, and the states decide for themselves whether abortion is going to be legal in that state and to what degree. But as long as Roe is preserved, then at least technically, every woman has a right to an abortion, and a state cannot criminalize it outright.
Okay. A big case that's before the Supreme Court now is the case regarding the constitutionality of the political boundary map in Texas that was spearheaded by the former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. What was your sense of the mood among the justices to this on this matter? Did you get the sense that they're leaning towards siding with those political boundary maps or not?
Do I think that they were inclined to support or at least not dis- disturb the delay redistricting. That was the general sense I got. But, and there's an important caveat here, there's really probably one justice who is the key on this, and that's Justice Kennedy, who has indicated in the past that so far he's voted to uphold partisan gerrymandering, but said that if he could ever see a very clear way of defining how much is too much and a clear remedy for that, he might opt for that. Well, he sure didn't sound yesterday or on Wednesday as if he thought that was an appropriate thing to do. But what he did, he seemed more concerned about what he viewed as racial gerrymandering. And the court has, in fact, held that racial gerrymandering is unconstitutional. And he had more questions about that than he did about partisan gerrymandering.
Mm. It must have been a surreal moment earlier this week when Anna Nicole Smith arrived at the Supreme Court.
I don't know about surreal. It was pretty funny, though. Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen that many cameras on the plaza of the Supreme Court. And they weren't. These were camera crews that had no microphones to speak of. They only wanted pictures of Anna Nicole, and they didn't get much. She went out a different entrance, and they caught her as she got into her what I called call a drug car. In other words, one of those big black SUVs that's just giant, that in the movies you see is always occupied by a drug dealer. Well, in this case, it was occupied by a bunch of lawyers and Anna Nicole Smith, and they got a picture of her in the car leaving, and I think one of her walking into the courthouse. But they didn't get anything else. And if you had been inside the courtroom, you would not have even known that Anna Nicole Smith was the subject of this case, which involved a rather technical question of which court gets to hear a probate question and which court gets to hear a tort question. But since her real legal name is Vicki Lynn Marshall, she didn't even get referred to as Anna Nicole. She got referred to as Vicki.
The Supreme Court justices seem, I think, to most people in the country to be rather mysterious figures. We don't see them when they are on the bench, and they're not very public, I think, at least not outside of Washington, D.C., as people. You must see them when they're not on the bench. Which justice would most surprise us because of how he or she actually is in their private life, in a way perhaps is quite different from their public persona?
Well, my guess is that the person who would most surprise anybody who reads a fair amount about the court is Justice Scalia, because he's hilariously funny and very puckish in his sense of humor and very open to people of all points of view. He'll take them on and he'll give as good as they give. But I think they'd be surprised, because I think he gets sort of caricatured as some sort of a dour conservative, and he's anything but dour.
Mm. Clarence Thomas's caricature is that he's Antonin Scalia's sort of sidekick and not as smart perhaps as the other justices. Can you shed any light on the real Clarence Thomas?
Well, I think that's kind of demeaning to Justice Thomas. He writes opinions. One may or may not agree with them, but they don't seem stupid. They seem way to the right of Justice Scalia, for example, but they do not represent a person who's stupid, for example. Mm-hmm. He says very little in public, so there is very little way to judge who he is, what he is, except by his written product, and it is what it is. It is a very lucid exposition of a 19th, or one might even say 18th century view of the law.
Which is?
Oh, you couldn't begin to. It's all different things in different areas. I mean, it depends what it is. But if you're talking about constitutional law, you're talking about somebody whose views would have been very comfortable on the court over 100 years ago in some ways.
Do other justices share that?
To varying degrees, but I think he has very little respect for precedent in the area of constitutional law, as opposed to statutory law.
Mm.
Who has been, in your opinion, the most important Supreme Court justice in the 30 or so years you've been covering the court?
That's pretty hard to say. I mean, if I had to say that this minute today, I would say probably Justice O'Connor was. Certainly she was in the last 10 to 15 years that I've covered the court. And it's interesting to note that O'Connor really didn't become O'Connor for about the first 10 years she was there. At some point after she'd been there 8 or 10 years, she seemed to sort of move into a whole new era of self-confidence and understanding where she was going and why, and never looking back. And she was often the deciding vote, either for conservatives or for liberals. Prior to that, I would have to say probably that Justice Brennan was. He was the architect of many of the liberal views of the court that we frankly take for granted today, including, you know, everything from prayer in public schools to some of the ideas in Roe versus Wade to, you name it, a whole line of criminal cases about not using the fruits of illegal police conduct. Like it or not, he was the architect of those liberal views. And before that, you would have to say Chief Justice Earl Warren, who was the architect of the perhaps most important decision of modern times, Brown versus the Board of Education.
You mentioned Sandra Day O'Connor. Do you think that she made a conscious decision to become that influential swing vote, frequent swing vote on the court, or was that something that she moved slowly towards?
Neither one. I think because the court was so evenly divided between so-called conservatives and so-called liberals, and you would have to say that the court moved dramatically to the right between, let's say, 1985 and 95, by virtue of the composition of the court changing, so that Justice Stevens and Justice Blackmun, while they might have, for example, moved a little bit to the left, they were once considered on the conservative end of the court, and the court moved so far to the right that they became the left of the court. And she then became the center of the court. And just because on so many critical issues, whether they were criminal law issues or reapportionment issues or abortion or prayer in schools or aid to parochial schools or you just name it, so often, not in every case, but so often, whichever way Sandra Day O'Connor went was the way the court went. And I don't think she did that on purpose. I think she represented, in fact, the center of the court. And part of the reason she represented the center of the court is she had a very pragmatic approach to the law. I once said when I was interviewing somebody, I was writing a piece ahead of time about her retirement on the assumption that at some point she would retire or die, and so I'm writing this piece. And I said to one of her law clerks, I said, you know, she's criticized often for slicing the salami so thin she can't tell it's been sliced at all. And the law clerk said to me, well, you know, often when you slice the salami really thick, you butcher it. Her idea is you just do as much as you have to. And because she really didn't want to go further than she had to very often, she And because her approach was so pragmatic, where she went was where the court went, because she was represented the difference that was the distinction, or the distinction that was the difference.
And finally, Nina, you've been covering the Supreme Court for a long time now. What keeps it fresh for you?
Well, it's never the same. It's always different issues. Now, look, we've got two new justices this year. What could be more interesting? And the issues always are the focal points, the controversial points of our times. And so that keeps it very interesting.
Yeah. Well, Nina Todenberg, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
NPR legal correspondent Nina Todenberg. She speaks tonight at the Mondavi Center at UC Davis. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, playwright Eugene O'Neill is the subject of a new documentary. Filmmaker Rick Burns talks about why he chose to make a film about the author of Long Day's Journey Into Night. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Next time on Insight, Indian tribes are increasingly powerful players in Sacramento. You'll hear what impact they're having. Also next week, an adopted woman who, in her 50s, just discovered she has 16 siblings. And a talk with cowboy poet and ex-veterinarian Baxter Black. There's more on recent and future insights on our website, capradio.org/insight. When you list America's greatest writers, playwright Eugene O'Neill would surely be at or near the top. His masterpieces include Long Day's Journey Into Night, Morning Becomes Electra, and The Iceman Cometh. He won a Nobel Prize and 4 Pulitzer Prizes. Eugene O'Neill is now the subject of a documentary. It'll be shown tomorrow night at the Mondavi Center. It'll air on PBS later this month. The film is by Rick Burns. He'll present it tomorrow at the Mondavi Center. He joins us now by phone. Rick Burns, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
In an interview about this film, I read that you said there was no American theater before Eugene O'Neill. What kind of theater did Eugene O'Neill create that was American?
Interestingly, it was really the theater of his father, James O'Neill, who was really one of the great matinee idols of the 19th century and played the role of the Count of Monte Cristo about 5,000 or 6,000 times in the late 19th century. It was comedies of manner, sort of Baudelaireized versions of Shakespeare, and really kind of horrendously bad melodramas of one kind or another. Serious theater in the 19th century in America meant Shakespeare, meant borrowings from Europe, and it really wasn't until after the First World War that a kind of a very serious, naturalistic, tragic American theatrical tradition sprang up, and its first standard bearer was Eugene O'Neill.
And was that Eugene O'Neill's intention, or did he just write the plays he did, and it turned out that they really started serious American theater?
It was really the former, not the latter. He was an Oedipal battle he engaged with his own father. I mean, he said when he was still in his early 20s, someday the name James O'Neill, which was known across the country in the early 20th century, someday the name James O'Neill will be famous only because he was the father of Eugene O'Neill. And he set out explicitly to revolutionize American theater, and he did. If he had not written his late great masterpieces, he would be remembered by scholars as the person who broke all the windows, banged the door down, and let in the fresh air of a kind of very serious, high cultural tradition in American theater.
How interested was Eugene O'Neill in commercial success, and regardless of what he thought about it, how commercially successful was he during his life?
You know, that's such a great question. He was always incredibly uncompromising as a playwright. He insisted on doing it his way. It was his way or the highway. From the very beginning, he refused to cut anything from his plays. His plays sometimes ran to 9 hours long in the case of Morning Becomes Electra. But at the same time, so he was an uncompromising and in some sense an avant-garde artist. But you know what? His father's old blood and thunder, blood and guts theater was bred in his bones. And there was a way in which O'Neill could reach a very wide audience, even when he was doing things experimental, because he knew about staging, he knew about characterization, he knew how to make moments and scenes come alive in a very powerful way. But having said that, he was a person who was so relentlessly uncompromising, one of the things I find so moving and admirable about him.
What great playwrights do you think, or do you know, that Eugene O'Neill looked up to and was inspired by?
You know, Strindberg, Ibsen, Chekhov, the great high line of European modernists were the ones that he was really emulating, and in a sense, Shakespeare. But what he saw is he really understood in the second decade of the 20th century that America was under-retailed in serious theater. He would say, he looked around, he said, where are the Chekhovs? Where are the Ibsens and the Strindbergs who are actually doing for American theatrical culture what these great playwrights have done for European theatrical culture? And he realized, like a kind of a skilled marketer, that it was under-retailed in those areas and went, listen, I'm going to do it. I'm going to be the guy who busts open the windows and lets the fresh air in. And he did, I mean, in an incredible way in the 1920s. His career just took off after 1919. His first three-act Broadway play, Beyond the Horizon, won a Pulitzer 3 years after the Pulitzer Prize was invented. And from there, his career was just a kind of a series of upward cascades across the 1920s and early 30s.
Mm. What inspired you to make a two-hour film about Eugene O'Neill? Was it principally his career and his drama, or was it the man himself?
You know, you start from a couple of facts. First of all, there's an extraordinary story here. Here's a man who won, during his lifetime, 3 Pulitzer Prizes and the Nobel Prize, and had yet, when he won the Nobel Prize, to write any of the great plays for which he was destined to be remembered. Iceman Cometh, Long Day's Journey Into Night, Moon for the Misbegotten. What's with that? I mean, there is no example in the history of theater that I can think of, and no example I can think of in literary history, where someone, after they had won every award they possibly could, goes on to write all the masterpieces for which he's remembered. It's an astonishing fact. It raises the question, why did it take him so long? Why did it take him a lifetime to teach himself how to write these particular masterpieces, which are recognized pretty much universally now as not only the high water marks of his life, but really the two or three greatest plays ever written by an American? And we wanted to tell the story of who was this man who took his whole life to finally turn around at the end of it and look very deeply into himself, especially, of course, in Long Day's Journey Into Night, but to a certain degree in all those late plays, to turn inward and grasp this kind of autobiographical, very complex, very dark material and find a diction and a theatrical form which he could project it in. I mean, it was an astonishing story. And the cost to the artist, in a sense, that's the thing I think that drew me more than anything else.
What do you mean the cost?
What does it cost to be an artist? I think that Americans in particular don't really grasp as deeply as they should what men and women who make careers in the arts give, what the sacrifice is all about. And in the case of Eugene O'Neill, the sacrifice was absolutely enormous. I mean, in a sense, you could say he sacrificed everything to his art, family relationships, two or three marriages, three children, anything that would resemble ordinary happiness, his health, because what it was most important to him was that he wrench from himself play after play that somehow gave form to his unique and very dark sense of existence. Mm. You know, he probably shortened his life. I think there's no question it shortened his life. And at the end, however, it was probably the case with O'Neill that he would have thought that despite all the cost, it was worth it. And so for me, for any human being who's ever tried to make something that wasn't shabby, that wasn't just sort of going to fall apart in 2 seconds, whether it's a chair or dinner or a child or a play, I think that there's something about this story, which I certainly know in my own experience when I examine my own life, is tremendously humbling and at the same time exhilarating because of what he was willing, the lengths to which he was willing to go to try to create something of permanent value.
Yes. He was born in New York, but he spent some productive later years in Northern California. Tell us where he lived and what he did there.
You know, he finished up his writing career in his last 10 years on a mountainside here, you know, above Danville, California. Very un-O'Neillian place. He'd been connected with the sea throughout his life before that, always lived in places like Provincetown, Massachusetts, Bermuda. He loved the sea, and he ended up finding his way here with his third wife, Carlotta, in the 1930s, right after he won the Nobel Prize in 1936. And settled down in this very un-O'Neillian landscape, beautiful but not his kind of landscape. And sitting on the upstairs study of a house here, his extraordinary house, Dow House, he channeled events and experiences and feelings going back 30, 40, and 50 years for him that were the most meaningful things that had ever happened to him. And it was as if, you know, he sat here in the study in this house, channeling those moments. He was here, but he wasn't here. He was really back in 1912, not in 1937 or 1939 or 1942. Yes. And he was intent upon, in a sense, reanimating those experiences from his own past, a long day's journey into night. I mean, in a sense, a long journey into his own past and into the darkness of his own family experience.
Mm. He strived so much in his life. Do you think he was at peace when he died?
No, I don't think so. I think he's a person who's profoundly not at peace his whole life. And maybe, if it's not too much of a paradox, he was at peace with not being at peace.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that that's a personality style, people who become comfortable with their own inner discomfort. And I certainly think that was the case with O'Neill. It didn't mean he wasn't always in some kind of turmoil. But I think he felt fatalistically that was his lot, and probably the lot of more people than cared to acknowledge it. And I think Yes. The power of O'Neill is the power of someone who is willing to express and say honestly hard home truths that most of us don't like to acknowledge every day and that might make us uncomfortable, Yes. But that we all recognize ourselves in.
Rick Burns, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Rick Burns, documentary maker. His latest film is about the playwright Eugene O'Neill. He's speaking and giving an advanced showing of the film tomorrow evening at the Mondavi Center. It also airs later this month on PBS. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley, who's also Insight's music editor. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us.